Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic Bee Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.theorganicbee.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter to @TheOrganicView, or you can contact me directly at June Stoyer. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. In this special series called The Neonicotinoid View, my special guest co-host Tom Theobald and I will be joined by Mark Emmerich, the past president of the Olympia Beekeepers Association in the state of Washington. He is currently the president of the Washington State Beekeepers Association. He will discuss the efforts to restrict the sale of neonicotinoids for ornamental use to individuals without a state applicator's license. So I would first like to welcome to the show my co-host, Tom Theobald. Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon, June.
And our guest today, Mark Emmerich. Good afternoon, Mark, and welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, June. Thank you for having me. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hello, Mark.
Mark, could you please tell our audience about yourself and how long you've been a beekeeper?
Well, I was born and raised in upstate New York, moved to Washington State 15 years ago, and bought a small plot of land, 13 acres, that I've started a farm on, and realized that we had a real lack of pollinators in my particular area. So about 8 years ago, I went out and went to a beekeeping meeting and just fell in love with honeybees and have had bees on the property ever since.
Mark, you were the past president of the Olympia Beekeepers Association, and in 2012, your organization drafted a letter to the County Agricultural Advisory Committee requesting restrictions on the neonicotinoid pesticides for use on ornamental plants. Could you just explain what led to this letter and what your thinking was at the time?
Well, originally we had started back in 2011, and we went to the Washington State Department of Agriculture and asked them what would it take to basically take neonicotinoids out of the ability to be purchased by the common gardener and plant lover and to give our honeybees a break. I had read at that point a great deal about it, more anecdotal evidence than actual solid scientific evidence back then, but a lot of things were pointing to the fact that this was really something that not only as a consumer of food, but also a beekeeper was alarming me at a lot of the anecdotal science and some small scientific studies that were done. So I spoke with my association, and they said, yeah, let's write a letter. The Department of Washington State Department of Agriculture said the only way that we could get a waiver to stop the sale in my particular county was to have the county commissioners actually request it. So that's what started the ball rolling with going to the county commissioners, and we actually worked with the county commissioners for a little over a year, giving them scientific data, meeting with them and their lawyers, and to the point where they were comfortable enough in actually producing the letter to the Washington State Department of Agriculture.
Didn't you have very high winter losses the winter of 2011 and 12? Was that part of it?
It was, and I cannot say, you know, it in its entirety because testing is so unavailable to the regular beekeeper, that's what it was. But we are having tremendous losses. We know that some of it's varroa. We know that some of it is other things that are stacking on top of this. But we also know that this chemical is out there, and it is depleting our honeybee populations. And so if we can at least control what we know is injuring our pollinators, then maybe we can get a better grasp on what's left over and how to treat that. But, you know, our bees leave our property. They fly out in all different directions to go out and get forage and come back again. And we have absolutely no idea what they fly through, fly into, what the pollen nectar is that they're bringing back. And certainly if it's contaminated, they're bringing it back to the hive. In the the particular case of the neonicotinoids, if they get into them, they may not make it back to the hive because of the ill effects on their central nervous system and actually being able to pilot themselves out and back again. So the hive automatically starts to dwindle, and it's very hard to wrap your head around the fact that you've got an organism with 30,000 moving parts, and each one of them relies on the other one for a specific job. As soon as you start to shorten their life expectancy, other parts of that organism have to take over their job, or the entire organism will perish. And I use the term organism as referring to the hive. So basically, it's just this nickel and diming them down to a part in their lives where the hive no longer operates efficiently any longer.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I believe it really gets opened up for other diseases and other pests.
You directed your letter to the County Agricultural Advisory Committee, and we wonder what was their response to that letter. What actions did they take?
Basically, their response to us was that they were advisory only and that they felt that this was not something agricultural based, but actually more politically based, and they don't make decisions on political issues. And if the Washington State Department of Agriculture is not looking into this as an ongoing matter, then they don't feel that they should advise them to do anything different than they're already doing.
The County Agricultural Advisory Committee then advised the county commissioners. What was their decision with respect to your request?
Once again, they really didn't put anything behind it at all. They really felt that the Washington State Department of Agriculture, if they felt that it was a problem, was, you know, all that they were going to do. And so they were going to take no position on it whatsoever. And that's the way they left it. I was kind of surprised because we had spent quite a bit of time going over this with a lot of people, and it just seemed like every time we would give them a study, every time we'd give them a scientific document, they would come back to us and say, well, that was kind of nice, but, you know, it doesn't really give us the full picture, and why should we worry about this in Thurston County? And it's because it's being sold by the ton at your local stores. That's why you should worry about it. But they really felt it was a political issue, and they didn't want to have any kind of input with it at all. They just backed their way right out of it.
Mark, could you explain to our audience exactly what ornamentals refers to?
Absolutely. In ornamentals, in the broad sense, more along the lines of anything that flowers, basically. So you've got flowers, of course, and then you have ornamental trees, grasses, and also a lot of vegetable and vegetation is also keyed as ornamental as well. So it would be pretty much anything in the backyard that was a cosmetic plant that is what we're concerned about more than anything else, because it's labels that you cannot read on the back of products that you can't apply correctly, even if you could read the labels properly. And it puts the consumer in a real bad situation because they want to use the product correctly. I don't think anybody goes out in their backyard thinking they're going to kill a honeybee. But if you take a look at the directions on use and quantities, and that, you know, so much of these products are inert ingredients, which we don't know what the inert ingredients are, that some a basic homeowner can't go out and use these products safely. It's just this deck is stacked against them before they even get started. And a lot of people just go out and prophylactically spray. They think that sooner or later the bugs are going to appear. So if they get to the plant and they spray it before the bugs get there, they're going to have just these gorgeous ornamental plants all over the place, and they don't have to worry about them. The insecticide will take care of everything else. And they really, truly believe that, you know, if this were to hurt pollinators, if it were to hurt, you know, and when we say pollinators, we have honeybees, you have butterflies, you have hummingbirds, all of these things are coming in contact with these pesticides. And they're systemic pesticides. They become part of the plant. It's not like pesticides we used many, many years ago where it sprayed on and killed whatever it was supposed to kill, and several days later, it would either evaporate or rain would, the next rainstorm would clean the plant back off again, and it would kind of reset everything. This actually literally becomes part of the plant, and as long as the plant survives, this stuff is in that plant.
Just out of curiosity, are any of the plants sold in your county labeled as having been treated with neonicotinoid pesticides at the nurseries or at the point of sale? Is there any labeling whatsoever on the plants actually anywhere that you know of?
No, not that I know of. I actually think that actually one of the huge selling points, I was just at a local farmer's market today, and there were huge signs all over the place that all of our plants are non-GMO, are non-treated, you know, and to use the organic label sometimes is kind of a misnomer. But they're hitting the points that people are really looking for when they're out there shopping for plants, and I think we're getting a more educated consumer than we've had before when it comes to plants. We just have to be able to educate them on pesticide usage and the fact that there are things out there that are injurious that the government says, you know, when they take a look at everything and they say, well, it's effective, it's inexpensive, and, you know, the kill rates for honeybees are inconsequential, so let's just put it on the market and we'll see what happens. And, you know, if we have to, we'll revisit it. And I'm an old guy. I go back to when, you know, DDT and some of the other stuff that we just threw on the market and thought, well, this is great stuff. It kills everything. Well, heck yeah, it does. And there's just no planning. There's no forethought what comes after this when it gets into the groundwater, when it contaminates other plants in the general area besides the one that you're literally looking at treating. It goes on and on and on. And
I think it's quite disturbing. I've been through the Master Gardener program, and I have done a lot of volunteer work in the state of New York for not only the county educational beds, but for other botanical gardens. And just knowing that there are so many plants, trees, shrubs, grasses, what have you, that have been treated at the nursery when they're being grown, and the consumer has no idea, that is a very big issue. But to boot, the fact that homeowners are not even able to understand or comprehend, rather, what the consequences are, that is really, really disturbing. Could you please share with our audience exactly how much of the land in your county is farmed as opposed to residential?
Actually, it's strange. The county that I live in is actually the capital of Washington State. Actually, is in our county boundaries. And probably our farmlands take up about 30% of the county as a whole, and the rest is residential and actually larger towns and cities as well. In our particular area, we do not have any GMO crops yet. Something that they have tried to keep out of the county at this point, and they've been doing a fair job with it. But also, I don't know how many actual plants, as you asked before, are actually pre-treated before they're being sold at the local stores. I don't believe that Washington State Department of Agriculture actually has anything in their labeling of plants that would actually make that the law. And as long as it's not the law, nothing's going to happen.
Thank you.
Mark, the county commissioners, if we look at the letters that lead up to this, the county commissioners apparently agreed with the beekeepers' concerns and forwarded that request to the Washington State Department of Agriculture requesting limitations for ornamental use. And the State Department of Agriculture had 60 days in which to respond, and responded just this week with a number of conclusions and suggestions, and I'm sure that you've read that. Could you share that with the listeners, and could you tell us just how you feel about what the State Department of Agriculture has said?
Certainly. Basically, at this point, with all the documentation that we've given us, they don't feel that it is an issue that they need to act on immediately. They would like to get more data from the county and more data statewide to see how much of this product is in use and if we can actually document bee kills. We do have a reporting system in Washington State. It's been convoluted since about 2000. We've stopped having a state beekeeper in 2000. We got rid of our apiary board in 2000. And so we're basically, if you're a beekeeper in Washington State, you're kind of sailing alone. There's not a lot of support from the state for beekeepers.
That's very common, actually. Many states have done the same thing.
They have.
Tom,
and it's definitely not to their advantage to do that.
Tom, could you perhaps jump in on this? Because you have experience as an inspector, what was it, for the county?
Well, yes. Colorado was one of the earliest states in the nation to have a bee inspector, both at the state level, and we had at the county level, every county that had an active beekeeping industry had a county bee inspector, and that position started in 1891. And over time, we lost those things, just as you're describing, Mark, and I was the last county bee inspector in the state of Colorado, and that position was retired in 2000.
Yep. Sad, because not only do beekeepers need the support and also the education, but if we have someone who is going around and documenting what is going on in particular areas.
Exactly. Yeah.
We can figure out where the hot spots are, where the problems lie, things that we can keep an eye on closer than trying to look at, we look at our hives as the entire entity about queen health and how's she laying and what are they bringing in for reserves. And the bulk of bees that we have in, and the hygiene of the inside of the hive. And if there's something else that we need to be looking for that we're missing, and our bees are paying the cost for that, that's on the beekeepers. But if we could get more volume of knowledge and get more data to figure out exactly where the problems are and how to stop them before we go over the cliff, then all the better. But my main concern is that, you know, in 20 years, we're not going to be having this conversation.
Well, I don't think we have 20 years. I think it's going to be much shorter than that. I have read the letter from the Washington State Department of Agriculture, and they make several recommendations, suggestions. I have to be honest, looking at these as an outsider, it looks to me like what we might call window dressing. There's nothing, they're positive, but there's nothing there of any real substance that would have much of an effect on the problem, if in fact there's a problem. It's sort of a look both ways before you cross the street, children. You know, we want the people to be more careful, and we want to have something on this label that nobody reads anyway. And it doesn't seem to me, as an outsider, that they have taken any strong stand whatsoever. How do you feel about that, and what do you think the next steps will be?
Well, I'm actually quite put off by the letter. You summed it up very beautifully. It basically is nothing more than window dressing. I've been in touch with some of the entomologists at Washington State University who have come forward just recently to ask if I could put forth some beekeepers for them to study their hives, take samples from, and see what kind of pesticide loads we do have in Thurston County. But right now, as the way it's been posed, it's a very, very small study. I really don't even know if it has funding or not. We're going to be meeting probably mid of next week on it to clear up some issues. The acting president of the Olympia Beekeepers Association met with them this morning to line out what they're going to need for beekeepers and who's going to be taking the samples, how they're going to be handled, so on and so forth. So we're trying to get whatever traction we can get off of this. There are other counties, as I'm president of the Washington State Beekeepers Association. This is all this information is also on our website. And so I've had other counties say, we want to do what you've done in Thurston County. And so how do we go about this? What do we need to put into place to get our county commissioners to make the same request? So it's just not going to be one county and it's a no and it's going to go by the wayside. This is going to be, as far as I know, two counties have actively put in letters requesting their commissioners, and I got four other counties that are working with their commissioners on letters right now that will be all going to the Washington State Department of Agriculture.
So the concern is growing.
It is. It is. And the more education that comes out and the more of the younger beekeepers who are a little bit more active than the older beekeepers are reading articles and getting a little bit more immersed in the science, the more it's they're realizing what kind of plight, what kind of a negative force we're up against when it comes to these particular group of pesticides. And they're getting more and more vocal about it.
Well, personally, if I can plug the show, Tom and I have been covering quite a number of different areas to really explore the impact of neonicotinoids, and I think we've done more than any of the mainstream media outlets or even other journalists that are on the internet. Are you going to create any type of public outreach where you can educate consumers, educate hobbyists, get the information out there so that people that really are not even remotely clued into what's going on can understand how serious this is?
Yeah, actually at the state level we do that a great deal, and it's asking we have 23 associate organizations underneath us in different parts of the state. And so we have asked them to, in their work, we do a lot of outreach as beekeepers, so you'll find us at fairs, you'll find us talking to Lions Clubs and garden clubs and master gardener associations, and make this a point to get this across to people that they really need to realize what they're doing and the depth of the devastation that they're causing every time they pick up a pump bottle. It's very hard to find venues where you can educate the public in really large populous areas, because today we've got the internet, we have cell phones, we have iPads, we have all this technology where they can get the news that they're particularly looking for in a real quick flash, and then they're off and doing stuff. So they don't get a balanced diet of what's going on in the world. They're picking and choosing what they feel is what they need to be concerned about. And so as venues trying to get information to the public, it's very, very difficult, because anybody can go out and buy these pesticides and use them. And so, you know, you can hit the people that you know are going to come in contact with them, as I say, garden clubs and that kind of thing, if they're not really well-read on the subjects. But you end up preaching to the choir, because 50% of these people wouldn't use the pesticide anyway. They would find a natural or a holistic way of treating for a particular insect, or they would actually get a pesticide that treats just for that insect, knowing that they could kill pollinators and good insects if they just massively sprayed everything in their backyards. But a lot of general consumers think that's why we have pesticides, is to make sure that my backyard is bug-free. And sadly enough, there's a lot of good insects that meet their demise because somebody is trying to have beautiful-looking roses. And the trade-off is horrible.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think the more that people understand the impact of neonicotinoid pesticides and they take a closer look at what it does not only to our pollinators, but the sublethal effects. I think that's what really makes people say, oh my goodness, you know, this is something that I don't want. I don't want it being used in my county. I don't want it being, I don't want to buy plants that have been treated with it, much less consume vegetables or fruit that has been treated with it. And the more reason to buy organic, plain and simple.
We've talked a number of times with Dr. Hank Tennekes, a toxicologist from Holland, and Dr. Tennekes has found and made it very clear that the effect of these neonicotinoid pesticides is cumulative and irreversible, and there is no safe dose, however small. It just takes a little longer to get to the end point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've actually heard some of his work and seen some of his work, and I think the other thing that a lot of people don't understand either is the half-life of some of these chemicals is extremely long. I mean, we should stop using them now, and 7 years from now, we're still living the effects of these things.
And sadly, it's showing up in the water as it has on Long Island, New York, and it's only a matter of time before more and more places where there has been a tremendous amount of the different products being used winds up in the test results when they test for water purification and water quality, rather. So
your neighboring state, I guess you're not neighboring, but to the south of you, California, was doing groundwater, surface water sampling, and found imidacloprid, which was the first neonicotinoid, found imidacloprid in 89% of the surface water samples that they took.
That is scary.
It is. And I have to applaud California because at least in California, they really take pesticide use very, very seriously just because it's almost a farm state, for lack of a better term, and they realize how much agriculture brings in the state. So I think their objectivity and their drive to make sure that they don't have contamination, that they don't have a lot of these other things is just absolutely miles and miles ahead of Washington State, who, you know, as a state, we don't even know how much of this stuff is actually being purchased and being utilized because you don't need any kind of a tracking on the product sale.
And unfortunately, when it comes to landscapers, and it's not even with products that contain the neonicotinoids, I found this to be true with many different landscaping companies where they will push product on the consumer that basically has a contract with them that says, you know, I will do X, Y, and Z for you during this time frame. And the homeowner, who is not necessarily educated as far as what proper lawn care consists of, just automatically assumes that, yeah, the lawn has to be fertilized. So when they automatically just administer a treatment and bill the customer, they think that that's par for the course. Meanwhile, the landscaping outfit should really be conducting soil testing to see if there is a need for the amendment. And unfortunately, the same is true with these types of chemicals. It's a matter of selling product that may or may not be needed in that particular area. But the fact of the matter is, as you said, these products are being used all over the place, and especially with ornamentals. I find it ironic that people want to attract the butterflies. They want to attract all the pretty pollinators. And then when they don't have anything coming to their yards, they wonder why. Bottom line, first question that you ask when you're doing a site inspection is, are you using pesticides? And if the homeowner says yes, well, there you go.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's... It's just time and time again. I see it at the state level all the time, and other people that I have spoken with that, you know, have had large bee kills and basically they did it to their own bees. And it was, you know, people who own orchards and people who are near grapevines and all kinds of stuff. And all of a sudden, you know, the neighbors or even themselves spray something, not realizing what the active ingredient is and not realizing, you know, the amount of damage they're doing when they lay this stuff down. And then they end up with these large die-offs, and it's like all of a sudden they go backwards then and realize, I just actually killed my own bees.
And I want to add something else to that. It takes many, many, many years to rebuild topsoil. Once you destroy the macro and microorganisms in your soil, you can't just go out and buy new soil. It takes a very long time. It's a living thing. So I applaud you for all of your effort, especially in your county and even statewide, to reach out to the public as well as beekeepers and help them to understand what's at stake here. So I wish you all the best. Please keep us posted. We would love to have you come back.
Thank you. I would enjoy coming back.
Thank you, Mark, for taking the time to talk with us.
Great. Have a great afternoon, folks. Thank you again.
Okay.
And, folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic Bee Radio Show. If you'd like to learn more about neonicotinoids, please tune in to the shows. Tom and I have been talking to scientists who have conducted peer-reviewed and published research and are really trying to do their part to educate the public as far as what these pesticides will do to the environment. So once again, please tune in each week, and thank you so much for tuning in. Have a great afternoon, everyone.